This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental
or additional to
the main topic in the margin of a book.
Big Read Wichita begins officially on Sunday, October 1st, and this will be the 10th year for the Wichita Public Library to organize events and encourage Wichitans to all read the same book during a six-week time period from October 1st to November 15th. This year's book is The Late Homecomer, a Hmong family memoir by Cao Kalia Yang. And it's actually the first nonfiction book selected for Big Read Wichita. Groups across the city have planned many events and community discussions, and a list of those events have been compiled at bigreadwichita.org. One such event includes a presentation, question and answer session, and a book signing by the author, Cao Kalia Yang. She will be at Newman University's De Matias Performance Hall from 7 to 9 p.m. on Thursday, October 12th, in an event that is free and open to the public. In anticipation of her visit and to prepare a bit for discussions I'm anticipating having on the bus or at the coffee shop, I spoke with Cao Kalia Yang about The Late Homecomer and her forthcoming visit to Wichita. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's our conversation. In the prologue, you wrote about the definition of Hmong. You wrote, Hmong was only skin deep. Skin is easy to penetrate. And, you know, in America, we're aware of the Vietnam War, but you told the story of the secret war. Can you explain a little bit about that?
During the Vietnam War, the Central Intelligence Agency of the United States, they organized the biggest covert operation in CIA history in Laos. They commissioned 32,000 Hmong men and boys. And when I say boys, they're 9, they're 10, they're 11, they're 12, to fight on America's behalf and to die on America's behalf. And so during the secret operation and war in Laos, a third of the Hmong died. And then after the Americans lost the war in Vietnam, when they left, they took 2,000 of the biggest supporters of the American cause with them, and they left the rest of us to die. The Communist Pathet Lao newspaper, Kaosan Pathet Lao, said it is necessary to extirpate down to the root the Hmong minority. And so after the Americans left, there was an effort to kill off the Hmong people for having helped the Americans in the war. My family was one of the hundreds of thousands left behind, and we were one of the lucky ones to make it to safety across the Mekong River and eventually to the United States of America. But even now in the American history books, when you learn about the Vietnam War, you learn about the Americans and the Vietnamese, the Viet Cong. You don't learn about what happened in Laos or the other vibrations of the war, what happened in Cambodia, what happened in the Philippines. And we're one of those unknown groups. Right now, Ken Burns has a huge Vietnam War documentary out, 20 hours. And it's sad because there is no mention within that 20 hours, there is no mention of the Hmong, America's biggest ally in that war, the people who died, so that lots of American soldiers could live. I don't know if you know this, but Hmong veterans of the war are not considered American veterans. So, for example, even General Vang Pao, the highest-ranked military leader, the one who worked directly with the CIA, when he died, the U.S. government refused to bury him as a veteran of war. So we are the unknown, the cost, the remnant of that horrible, horrible chapter in American history. That's the war that I come from.
Well, and then it even continues a little bit later, but I'll get to that. I have questions more about what happened even to the Hmong when you came to America. But I want to backtrack again. You know, you were born in Thailand in a refugee camp after your parents, your older sister, and your grandmother and many aunts, uncles, cousins escaped from Laos. And okay, were you in two or three camps?
My mom and dad, when they entered, they were in Nong Khai. It's a different refugee camp, but then they sent the Hmong to Ban Di Nai. Most of the Hmong ended up in Ban Di Nai, which is this camp in this incredibly dry part of Thailand that wasn't used for farming because it was too dry. There were no rivers, and so it was just empty territory. And that's where Ban Di Nai refugee camp was established for the Hmong. So that's the camp where I was born. Then before we came to America, we were processed in this Pananikum camp, which is a transitional camp that trained you for life in America. So for me personally, two camps, for my family, three.
You wrote that in the Bon Vinay refugee camp, you discovered the shapes of stories, how to remember them, and how to tell them. So you came from a family of storytellers?
Well, I come from an oral tradition. Legend says that a long time ago in China, we had a written language, but then the Han Dynasty did a cultural genocide, and so they took away the written languages of the Hmong people. Hmong women are known internationally for our embroidery and our story cloths. That was their effort to hold the language intact. And so when the language became outlawed, the women and the girls sewed it into their clothing and they hid it in the child carrying cloth in the hopes that the language would live for generation after generation. Meaning was lost, and now it's like a lost language of flowers. So we didn't have a written language, and it wasn't until the 1950s that a French missionary came to the high mountains of Laos and devised a written script for the Hmong. So all of my life growing up in the camps, because there weren't enough schools, I couldn't go to school. Although I turned six in the camp, I could go to school. My father has always said that with our words, we have to write on memory, that we don't have the crutch of the written word to remember each other by. And so all of my life, the only thing that the people had to give me, the adults, were stories. Stories of what was before the camp, because 400 acres, less than a square mile in radius, 40,000 of us in this bit of land where we got food 3 days a week. For the adults in my life, it was so important that I knew that that wasn't home. Home was some story of Laos. Home was an imagined future in America. Home was not that place where I had been born. My first sight of belonging, if there's such a thing in the world. So in Bon Vinay refugee camp, I took to the story. It was a way to open up my world.
Now, when you were at the camp preparing to leave for America, you couldn't sleep. You would be awake all night and even during designated nap time. But when you got to school, you couldn't stay awake.
No. So every Hmong person I know is haunted by something. I should say that so many of my generation are given recycled names or given the names of the people who died somewhere along the way without a burial, a goodbye, in the hopes that we could live lives so that the people can continue. And so we're also haunted. In Bon Vinay refugee camp, the number one cause of death was suicide. In Pananikum, on our way to America, I saw an old woman die. And in my culture, we believe that if you fall before the body of a dead person, they get your soul. And I fell. We wanted to see her body. And so me and a whole bunch of cousins went to a peak. And on the run away from the body, I fell. And so I believe that she took my spirit, and that took away my ability to sleep at night, because every time I closed my eyes, I would see her standing there in the corner looking at me, twice as tall as a normal person, eyes glowing in the dark. And so I lost my ability to sleep. And because I couldn't sleep at night, I would fall asleep during the day. And so my first practice school, I did not do well. And so I remember this very clearly. They moved me away from the regular schoolhouse to go to, I'm sorry, Beth, my daughter has come to visit me.
That good.
Thank you, honey. And my husband just took her out.
That is fine.
I'm sorry. I have a 4-year-old and an identical twin boys who are two. So.
Oh, how fun. Well, do you need to talk to him? That's fine.
No, I'm good. And they know that the lock to my office doesn't work. It's just there as a sign. So they come in here whenever they're unhappy with their dad. Yes, but so then I was sent to the child care center for kids. And there I had a notebook and a pencil. And I couldn't fall asleep with the other kids. And so I started what I thought was writing these books of interconnected circles that I believe told the stories of how I became, how the people became, sharing all of the stories that had been told to me all of those long years in the camps where we were just waiting in the dust.
Now, after you came to America, when you were in second grade and your sister was in third, she won a spelling bee. And you wrote that it was the first validation of the dream. Education was the answer to our lives' questions. And you explained that both you and your sister were learning to write English at the same rate, but not speak the language at the same rate. And you wrote, because writing did not take voice, I liked it better. And that actually reminded me of a quote from the prologue where you said, You wrote, because she hadn't said much in her first 20 years, all the words had been stored inside her. Talk to me a little bit about not necessarily finding your voice, but voicing your voice, because it was all there inside.
Yeah, it was. When we came to America, I remember getting tested at Battle Creek Elementary School, and the lady, who I'll never forget because I'd never seen a reindeer before, and her shirt had a reindeer on it, with a red sweater with a white reindeer. And she said, say your ABCs. And I said, A, B, and C. And then she said, say your ABCs. And I said, A, B, and C again. And I remember her shaking her head in sadness and despair. And then my sister was tested, and she said, A, B, and C, and she continued on to Z. And then she said that every color was yellow. And I remember thinking she's the smartest person I'll ever meet. In third grade, she did. She won the Northern Elementary School Spelling Bee just a year and a few months after we got to this country without the ability to speak the language. She somehow could take apart its units and piece it together again. So she got $50, and then she bought our father his first pair of dress shoes with that $50 so that he wouldn't be embarrassed to go with us to the parent-teacher conferences. Before that point, he'd gotten his shoes from the church basements, and they never fit. And so when my father walked, it would slap on the ground. And so he'd hold our hands really tightly, and we walked very slowly up and down the hallways at the various schools. And I remember thinking, one day if I could do that, that would be wonderful. But I also have this very clear memory of stopping my journey into English. You know, we'd just been here 7 months, and I was learning fine. But one day, Mom and I went to Kmart to get light bulbs because the light bulbs in our house had started flickering. We went up to the clerk, and my mother, who at the time was only 25, so, you know, 11 years younger than I am today, and I thought she was the most beautiful woman alive and very brave, because my father told me that Laos had been the most heavily bombed country in the world, and this is a fact. Every 8 minutes when they were growing up, bombs were being dropped on Sinkhorn province. The province where they were born was the most heavily bombed province of all. And my dad said that old men and women would run, but my mom would walk perched in parallel to the ground. And so that was always my image of my mother. But that day in Kmart, my mother said that she was looking for the thing that made the world shiny, because she didn't have the one word for light bulb. And my mother had this thick accent, and I could see the clerk tapping her hand on the counter. And the faster the tapping got, the harder it became for my mom. And after my mother was gone, the clerk walked away. And my mother held my hands, and we waited for the clerk to come back to tell us where the light bulbs were. But she didn't come back. And after about 15 minutes, my mother's head bowed. And that was the first time I saw her chin drop. And I decided, I was just a little kid, but I decided that if the world that we were living in, if it did not need to hear my mother and my father, then surely it didn't need to hear me. And so the next day, I started a revolution within myself. I refused to talk. At first, it was a great act of defiance, and I felt powerful. But then, slowly, the words in my throat got rusty, got sticky, got dry. And every time I tried to speak, I would sound weird. Then other kids started looking, and slowly, my voice died entirely. I became what was called a selective mute. And I stopped speaking in English at school. I got through the St. Paul public school system all the way through graduation by nodding and doing the thumbs up every time a teacher had a question or somebody looked my way. And so it wasn't until I went to college when one of my teachers, Professor Rich Kaiser, still at Carleton, he looked at me and he said, you know, it's selfish to just absorb knowledge if you don't give anything back. You're not here just to consume. You're here to produce. And I remember those words making me question myself and flipping the light at me. I was all of a sudden caught in the headlights of my own self. Still, I couldn't find a voice. It wasn't until The Late Homecomer came out in April of 2008 that I had to get up to speak, that I think my voice came back to me. I got up and I tried, and I sat down again because I couldn't. After the third time, at the third try, my father got up from the back of the room. He had on this Brooks Brother jacket that I bought him that year when I graduated. The year I graduated from Columbia, I had fellowship money left. I had $500. And I thought that was time for me to return the promise I'd made, fulfill the promise I made to myself all those long years ago when Doug bought my father the shoes for $50. I ordered him the jacket for $500. And my dad's a machinist, and he had no opportunity to wear. But on the night of my book launch, my father had on this nice jacket. And he walked up, and we were in this room full of like some 300 people. He walked up right before me. He put forth his hand. My hands are shaking, so I put my hand on top of his. And my father's hands, because he spent most of his life in America as a machinist, they're incredibly rough. He made this slice by metal many times. And so my father looked at me and he said, from hardness, you can give birth to gentleness. He said, if volunteers can reincarnate, we would reign the world with our sorrow. But because they cannot, they can only clean the mountains of Pumbia. But if you speak, if the winds of humanity blow, then maybe our lives were not lost. And my father turned back and walked all the way back to his seat. And I thought about his words. And I got up and I spoke for the first time to be heard, above a whisper with a microphone in my hand. And I got the power and I think the strength to speak that day, because I knew so keenly and so clearly that two other people died so I could be here. I was the lucky one. And if I couldn't speak for myself, maybe I could speak for them. And that was the beginning of the journey.
You know, because you just mentioned your mother going to Kmart and how the clerk treated her, you wrote earlier about how when you got to America, you were not treated kindly by Americans. Did they not understand that you did not have a country to which you could return?
My family came in the late 80s. We were part of the biggest throng to enter the country, and many of us came to California and then Minnesota. So we were coming in numbers where we were making a mark on the city, but no, nobody knew what we were doing here. The average American had no idea what we were doing here. And at school, my teachers didn't know what we were doing here. It was the first time that they were meeting Hmong people. You know, I got asked, is Hmong from Mongolia? And other questions, because they had no idea. And then when we said we came from the war, they'd assume that we were Vietnamese. But then we shake our heads and say we were Hmong. Very few people knew what we were doing here. The newspapers at that time, if you go back to the archives, are all full of stories about people throwing eggs at Hmong houses, terrorizing and destroying Hmong gardens. It was not a friendly time to enter the country. You know, we were in an economic depression. There were a lot of poor folk entering. And so a lot of people were thinking we're there to take from this pot that was dwindling. The times are not so different from today, actually, and the responses to refugees these days. But it was a hard time to enter the country. I have very clear memories of standing outside of the Magana Housing Project, this housing project that had been built for soldiers returning from the World War II, but of course had become low-income housing for the Hmong and other groups coming into the country. And I'd stand there, and then these cars would speed by on Timberlake Road, and people would throw empty bottles at me. I was just a kid, and they didn't want to hit me, but they wanted a bottle to shatter around me. And I remember picking up the broken pieces of glass and thinking that I found diamonds in a world that dreamed of them. I used to come home with handfuls of broken glass and tell my mom and my dad that I found diamonds. And instead of shattering the dreams of a little girl, my mom would say, what do you want to do with them? And I told her that I wanted to bury them for other little boys and girls to find. And so all over that first house, 1475 Timberlake Road, apartment C, I buried broken glass, diamonds, for other children to find. It was not a friendly time.
Talk to me a little bit about your grandmother. When you wrote about journeys that she had traveled, you said, she quickly became the most remarkable person I knew.
My grandma was a very experienced grandma. She had over 100 grandchildren by the time I came along, so she was an old pro. Because I came at the latter end of her life, she was down to a single tooth. And I thought she was incredible because with that single tooth, we took down Jolly Ranchers, ice cubes, we gnawed on bones. There was never a food that she said no to. She ate everything that I ate, experienced and sampled everything that I knew to offer. My grandma only knew two English words, and it was low and no. So she'd pick up the phone and say low. If it was an English-speaking person, she'd say no and hang up. And I thought that was so cool. In a world where I was watching my mother and my father fall into English and try to pick themselves up again, where I myself was struggling, to have my grandma there, not interested in the learning of a language, but just living within it with what she had, was remarkable. So my grandma was my superhero. My grandma was the one who thought I was beautiful, although we couldn't afford braces. So my front teeth come together at a small angle, and all of my life I've wanted braces. And I used to ask my mom and dad, can I get braces? Can I get braces? And of course I couldn't because they didn't have the money. But instead of telling me no, they'd say things like, oh, maybe next year, maybe next year. And one day I was asking, and my grandma looked at me. She smiled with her single tooth, and she said, Midnight, is my smile not beautiful? And I looked at her. I said, no, your smile is beautiful. And she said, then yours is gorgeous. You know, my grandma was that person in my life whose idea of beauty, ideas of life, extended far beyond America. My grandma had come from the other side of the world. In a war where so many young people had died, she, an old woman, had survived. Everybody who loved her before me was gone already. And yet she was there for all of us. An umbrella, we say, an umbrella of love for all of us. And so I grew up incredibly close to my grandma. I grew up for many years thinking that she was a perfect human being.
You wrote, the Hmong had died too many times, and each time their deaths had gone unwritten. There were no testimonies. The witnesses grew old, and they died, and life continued as if they had never lived. I didn't want this to happen to my grandma. And so you started collecting her stories and telling her stories.
Yes, I think I've always collected her stories. Because my grandma would say, from my earliest memories, she'd say, you have to record my words, son, because when I'm gone, you won't remember them. And although we had no tape recorder, although I had no video camera, in my heart, I've been recording her ever since I can remember. My grandma, she never got a chance to go to school, so she didn't know how to read or write. And her biggest fear was always that she would be forgotten. So the book itself, The Late Homecomer, started after my grandmother had died. Spring was coming. Spring was her favorite season. I was about to graduate, and she'd always said that education was a garden that I cultivated in America, and that one day we would go and reap the harvest together. And I knew that day wasn't coming because my grandma was gone. And so I started writing a love letter to my grandma to tell her of all of the things that I would never forget about her. I was on page 36 when my dad came into the room and asked me what I was doing. So when I told him that I was writing this love letter to my grandma, my dad said to me, he says, Meinai, if you dream in the right direction, the dream never dies. You never wake up. It always grows bigger. And so then the idea was born. What if the world remembered her with me? This woman who never learned how to read or write, but who lived a life and learned the important lessons that we all can stand to learn from. And by that time, I was beginning to understand what knowledge was, right? It wasn't the fact that matter could not be created or destroyed. That's what I was taught a long time ago, or my siblings who are now taught, that with massive amounts of energy, you can create small bits of matter. Knowledge changes. The only thing that doesn't is the lesson, the lesson that we learn from the living of our lives, documented so that it could be shared. And so that's what I wanted to do with my grandma's stories. I wanted to write them down, the story of her life. I was young when I started the book, 22, and so I didn't think I was writing a memoir. I thought I was writing a biography. But then in the process, I discovered that by writing her stories, I was indeed documenting my history, and not only my own, but that of a generation. And then, of course, whenever I shared the manuscript, other people would tell me, that's my story, too. You know, and this was refugees from Africa, Eastern Europeans. They were saying that this was my story, too. Then I knew that I was engaged in a bigger project, that I was speaking to a bigger human experience. But yeah, in the beginning, all it was a love letter to my grandma, an effort to remember her. The hard thing about being human is that you know how much you're forgetting when you're trying hard to remember.
When I was reading this book, your grandmother, you would say some of her quotes, and she said to you, oh, you asked her if she ever went hungry, and she said, you do not think so much about hunger if you have never been full. You know, there was a description of when she would come to stay at your home and her bags would be stacked along the wall in the room where she was staying, where your bed was. And you said she carried everything with her, unable to trust the safety of place. And she carried everything with her across the river when your family escaped from Laos to Thailand, too, yes. Didn't she? I mean, she did not want to let anything go.
No, she carried all of her shaman's tools. It's a wonder that she made it because those tools are heavy. The iron gong, the sacred buffalo horns, her ring of coins. She carried all of it across that river.
One of the things she was worried about was that her spirit would be able to find her way back home. And, you know, another thing, when your mother's mother died, the grandmother in Laos, when she died, your mother said that there was nothing for her in Laos now. She was the only reason for her to return. And I'm just curious, have you ever returned to Laos, or has your father?
Yes, in 2010. My older sister and her husband went back to Laos, Southeast Asia, excuse me. He was working in Cambodia, and so they were having their first child, mom and dad's first grandchild. And my parents went back to make sure that would be okay. And we all knew that if they made it back to Thailand or Cambodia, that we'd get them plane tickets to take them back to Laos. And they tried to go, but at the Luang Prabang Airport, my mom's brothers were waiting on the other side. And my dad walked through, and security said, "You can't go through." And my dad said, "Why?" They're like, "We don't need to explain why." And then they said, "Give us your passport." And he did. And then they said, "We've kicked you out of our country once. Do you want us to do it again?" And my dad said, "Excuse me?" And they said, "We cannot guarantee your safety. The moment you leave this airport, we cannot guarantee your safety. If you want to live, then you should buy a one-way ticket out of Laos right here, right now." And my father looked at my mother, and he knew that her family was waiting for her on the other side. And he told her that she should go through, that he would return on his own. But my mom couldn't do it. And so she and my father walked back on hiked up one-way airline tickets back to Thailand. So they never made it. They stepped on Laos, but they never made it beyond the Luang Prabang Airport. In November of this year, my older sister and I hoped to take them back. And we were going to try to drive into Laos so that we don't have to fly into Laos. Because my mom's oldest brother, who always said that he never needed a blanket after their father's death because he had her to warm his heart. He's 80 years old, and he's now 80 pounds. And last year, his wife died. And he himself thought that he was going to die. He wanted my mom to say goodbye to him on the phone, but she couldn't. And so she asked him to wait for her return. So November 28th of this year, we hope to take them back. I don't know if we'll be able to get into Laos, but we're both going. On the off chance that if my father is held again and told to leave, then I can leave with him and my older sister can walk with her, return with her to see her family and the place where her mother was buried. No, my mom was only 16 when she left her mother. And once a week, she wakes up from this nightmare where she's walking away from her mother. They're in the jungles of Laos. Soldiers are coming, and my father tells her that they have to leave. And she walks away, and she doesn't say goodbye to her mother. She wakes up, and she cries and cries. And so it's time. She's now an old woman herself. Her eldest brother is not doing very well. It's time that she returns and makes peace with this promise that she was never able to keep, the promise to see her mother again. So yeah, this year, we'll see if we can get in. I think that one of the most important things about the late homecomer, and perhaps the thing that we haven't talked about, is that, you know, it was the first literary book by a Hmong author to be published in America and to gain national distribution. And I knew that it would be one of the first. We've been here for like 40 years already. But because we're new to what is written, it's taken us a long time. Like lots of immigrants and refugees, mom and dad said that they needed doctors and lawyers. And though, because she won that North End Elementary School spelling bee, said that she would become our lawyer because perhaps she was good with words. And I was a selective mute, but I went to all of these schools thinking that I would become a doctor. And obviously, I'm not a doctor. When you think about the late homecomer, when you read it, it's very much a young writer's effort to heal what is broken in the hearts of people who love her, who made her. I want to use words the way I would use medicine. I want to use them to heal. No, I cannot take the shrapnel out of the feet and the hands and the arms of the people who love me. But I can carry some of the stories that they're afraid the world will forget. And I can share those stories with a bigger world so that the dream of who we are can grow. And by we, I'm not just talking about the Hmong, I'm talking about the American. You know, so many of us come from somewhere to call this place home. And it's a wonder how quickly we forget that not so many generations ago, we spoke to each other with thick accents. And so we think that's really the value and the importance of the late homecomer. And that's why I'm so excited to come to Wichita to share the story. Not only because I think the Hmong story is an important one to the history of the world, because I think it's an important reminder to Americans how we become one nation, one people, that we are also late in the coming home to each other.
That was Cao Kalia Yang, author of the book The Late Homecomer, a Hmong family memoir, which was published by Coffee House Press. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. Discover new episodes at KMUW.org or on iTunes. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita. Our editor is Luann Stevens. Our engineer is John Cyphers, and I am the producer. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.